Hello, everyone, and welcome to another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and with me, as always, Scott Morris.
Delighted to meet you.
And Drew, in a normal voice, Tavendale.
Middle name's changed again, has it?
Yeah. Oh, no, I've got the hiccup.
Greetings.
Yeah, we'll see if I can carry that normality through to the outro, which is usually where it becomes an issue of contention. Four films to talk about this time round, so without further ado, let's crack on. So, Drew and Scott, what is all this with, what's his name again?
I don't know, Dick Van Dyke, but...
What's not even the right voice. It's not even the right voice. That's bad. What's all this about Jason Statham? Hey? What's all this, hey?
It's a bit vague still.
What's all this?
Care to narrow that down at all?
I've heard of Jimmy the Stout that Jason Statham has got a new film out. It's called Parker and that. What's that all about, hey?
Oh, okay. Now we've established quite what it is about Jason Statham. Yeah, this is Parker, as you mentioned.
Yeah, you slag.
A character that you may have seen before. It's based on a character by a writer called Donald E. Westlake. And the Parker character, though not with that name until now, has been in Made in USA, The Outfit, and perhaps most notably in Point Blank and Payback. So the Stath plays Parker. There's not really a lot of setup in this film. He's part of a criminal gang. Parker sets himself apart by having morals, which is... amusing. He's a something of a latter-day Robin Hood, it seems. Well, perhaps not, because he doesn't give this away, but he won't...
Rolls from the rich, keeps it to himself, Parker.
He has a couple of rules. He always sees the job through, never reneges on a deal, and good never man. Steals from people who can't afford it, which is probably just a sensible thing for a criminal, because if they can't afford it, they won't have anything to steal. But, sorry to read in your parade there, Parker. You great philanthropist.
I don't steal from no one that doesn't have nothing to steal, all right?
Having set out loudly early on that he never reneges on a deal and expects other people to deal with him in the same manner, after...
slightly naive.
Yes, because criminals are so trustworthy. And
fair enough, Parker. Let's conduct our business.
After robbing the money office... The money office? Yes, I'm sure that's what they're actually called. The money office of a state fair. The leader of the gang he's working with, Michael Chiklis, decides that he's not going to give Parker his money. Instead, he needs it to set up his next score. And Parker rather takes umbrage with this and says, no, gee's my money. Michael Chiklis says, no, I'm not giving you my money. And Parker says, oh, go on.
I didn't realise it was a dramatic retelling we were going to have.
It's set in Springburn, can't you tell? So, in the end, Michael Chiklis decides that the only way he can get over this impasse they're in is to shoot Parker in the face, which he doesn't do, because apparently shooting from a foot away is too difficult for him. Shoots him in the chest instead. They throw him out of the car.
Fucking Parkinson's.
Yes. Throw him out of the car, shoot him again, leave him for dead. There we go. That's it. Parker wakes up. Parker wakes up in hospital. He's a bit pissed off and decides to go and take revenge on them. That's really the setup and the story, more or less, in irrelevance.
Does he decide to take revenge on them because he's angry about it, or because he disagrees with their morals?
Both. He's a complicated criminal, Parker.
Deep, very deep. Oh, Statham.
So, having tracked down what their next job is, he moves on down to Palm Beach, gets some help and some slight comic relief from Jennifer Lopez's real estate agent, and as you might expect, he goes about with extreme prejudice taking his revenge on the people he was working with.
I should point out, Jennifer Lopez is playing an estate agent. It's not actually Jennifer Lopez's estate agent who's in this film.
Yeah, she did turn up. It wasn't so beneath her that she just sent some lackey.
How well does she portray this estate agent? Does Parker often find it difficult to get a hold of her on the phone when he needs to?
She's actually not a very good estate agent, so she's always available because she doesn't even have any clients.
Oh, schoolboy era.
Yes. I'm just going to use Scott's tweet on our Twitter stream here. That's twitter.com/theoneliner, listeners. Parker is a quite relentlessly competent movie. It's super generic, but a reliable, gruff, grim performance from Statham wins through. That's it. I couldn't put it any better. Yes, it's very, very generic, but it's not... It's above mediocre. It's entertaining enough because Statham's entertaining. Going by Statham standards, it's certainly not The Transporter, which you'll be pleased to know. I generally don't think there's anything more to say about it because it's a crime film with Jason Statham in which he plays Jason Statham. And it's quite fun, if more or less entirely unmemorable.
Yeah, it's very much Statham by the numbers, isn't it? There's really nothing wrong with it. I was writing up notes earlier, and the more I started to write about it, the more sort of snarky I would get about it, just because there's not really much else to talk about. It is perfectly fine. There's really nothing wrong with Parker at all. It's,
yeah, that's it. It's unmemorable. It's not going to bother anybody's films of the year list, but it's hardly going to be in the stinkers either. That was quite fun for 90 minutes. Next, please.
Yeah, everyone's doing well. Statham can do this kind of role in his sleep. Jennifer Lopez, of all people, is actually quite likable in this, and that's not something you would ever expect.
It's not common, certainly.
The villains they've got are a reasonable mix of thugs and threats and cowards, and that kind of works quite well. It's a reasonable little rogues gallery to go up against. The sort of heist plans are fairly reasonable and entertaining, and they're not completely ludicrous.
Can I stop you just for a second, Scott? Because I have remembered the one issue I had with it, which I did mention to you when we were in the cinema watching it. It has Nick Nolte in it as his Parker's father-in-law, or more or less the same thing. When was the last time you understood a single word Nick Nolte said?
He's got a bit mumbly lately, hasn't he?
He has. I think I got maybe three words in Gangster Squad.
Yeah. But he had a better suit there, so at least he had a bit more gravitas behind him there. But
We caught the last half hour of Hulk was on like ITV2 last night, I think, or something like that, and we caught the last half hour of it, and he's utterly incomprehensible in that as well. So he seems to be talking in a very low monotone about cotton wool and bees or something, I don't know.
Even 10 years ago he was incomprehensible. When was the last thing you remember being able to hear Nick Nolte clearly? It's a long time.
Does Nick Nolte have a Twitter feed? I'd be intrigued to see if he posts vowels. Anything with vowels in it,
Maybe a single consonant in there.
Oh, bless him. Old Nick Nolte, yeah.
You just have to infer old what you
Nick
said
Nolte
by Parker's actions.
Not much else to add to Parker. I enjoyed it quite a lot. My only real annoyance with it is that it seems to have basically from the outset to have aimed for okay and all right and fine. And I get the impression that there's enough talent there, and there's a few sort of moments where it does kind of get where you see glimpses of something that could actually be quite good. Like one particular fight that winds up in the balcony, which is really quite well executed. And you kind of get the impression that if people had kind of put a bit more gumption into it, then this could actually be quite good instead of being, good.
Certainly in terms of other films with the same character or takes on the same character, it doesn't compare to Payback at all. But the scene with your document, Scott, with the balcony, the scene with the knife and the hand does compare quite favourably to the hammer scene in the toes.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, there's just a few moments where you think this could well have been something actually pretty good rather than just, decent. I don't want to denigrate it too much because, after all, it is still decent, and I've seen enough rubbish films that even apparently making a decent one's harder than it looks. So it's worth a look if you've any interest in this sort of crime genre. I would give it a go. I wouldn't necessarily rush out to see it at cinema. I think this will hold up equally well in the home formats, so perhaps keep an eye out for it there.
Much like The Mechanic, then. He plays well at home, Statham, but I've yet to see him sort of convincingly carry something on the big screen, even though I would like to see him do that, because he's an eminently likable presence.
I cannot recall now if I saw Crank 2 at the cinema. I suspect I didn't. I think you would
you
have did. Carried that.
You saw it with me at the cinema, Scott. Yes. I saw Crank 2 at the cinema, which was a hit.
Yeah, I think that was possibly his cinematic high point for me, just because it's so daft.
Oh, it's batshit mental.
But he even managed to be pretty decent in cinema in Death Race.
That's true, yes.
Which really surprised me, particularly given it was directed by Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yes.
Directed in the loosest of terms. On then to the incredible Burt Wonderstone, in which Steve Carell and Steve Buscemi play childhood friends who, alienated by their peers, form a friendship based on magic tricks that eventually sees them earning millions as Las Vegas casino double act Burt Wonderstone and Anton Marvelton. After a decade of success, Burt and Anton have become complacent, and their packed shows suddenly see a drastic drop in audience when flamboyant street magician Steve Gray begins plying his trade on the strip. Burt and Anton are dismissive of Gray's new school magic, seeing it more as a series of feats of physical endurance than traditional magic, but are forced to reevaluate their stance when casino manager Doug Money, played by James Gandolfini, threatens them with the hook. One ill-advised stunt later, and Burt's ego costs he and Anton both their relationship and their double act. And as Anton leaves Vegas to pursue other interests, Burt slides deeper into financial ruin and emotional despair. What follows is an unfortunately predictable narrative of loss and redemption, as Burt stumbles upon his childhood inspiration, legendary magician Rance Holloway in an old folks' home, causing Burke to rediscover his passion for the roots of magic and blah, 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 blah. There are a number of issues that the incredible Burke Wonderstone struggles to surmount, but chief among them is the flat and largely uninspired direction of Don Scardino, a regular helmer of TV's 30 Rock and head of the Scardino crime family. In fairness to him, Scardino was making a film about the wonder of magic in a studio system that buys said magic by the pixel, and it's asking a lot of an audience to experience any sense of wonder when each practical magical routine is complemented by some obvious CG counterparts. For that reason, we need to want to invest in the characters and the performance thereof, and here at least there is some enjoyment to be had. Carell and Buscemi, neither of whom are here operating at the top of their game, are at least enjoyable in their roles, even though their partnerships, both fictional and on-screen, fail to ignite as one might hope. Olivia Wilde is sadly underused as a budding assistant whose presence serves mainly to give Burt a reality check from time to time, and ultimately, insert surprised face here, provides some love interest. She really ought to get herself a better agent, to be honest with you. Fortunately, Alan Arkin is dependable as Rance Holloway, and even though he quite visibly lacks interest at points, he is nonetheless Alan Arkin, a man who embodies the essence of dry Jewish wit and probably couldn't not be funny even on pain of death. The biggest laughs, however, belong to Jim Carrey, who's fantastically well cast as Grey, a man who's increasingly apparently unhinged in his desire to pursue ever more outrageous acts of physical mutilation while at the same time projecting a false facade of pretentious zen in private. While he fails to elicit enough animation from the remainder of his cast, Scardino does at least manage to pull off that most magical of tricks himself and keeps Carey on a tight enough leash that he never unleashes more of that manic energy than is appropriate, even when performing such stunts as spending a night sleeping on hot coals and drilling into his own skull. My biggest, none of which are magic, he literally just does to his own skull and sleep on hot coals. My biggest gripe with Wonderstone is that it is, in the end, so decidedly average. The Vegas pomp and theatricality of such acts should really be a rich seam of inspiration, and while the production team, especially the costume and set departments, have done a bang-up job, their director, in combination with a lacklustre script, have failed to follow through for them. The most promising thing I can think to offer is that at a budget of $30 million, it will, hopefully, at the very least, break even on the back of its star power alone. I was massively, well, not massively disappointed by Burt Wonderstone, because I'm growing increasingly concerned that comedy is following horror down this stale genre path where the least amount of effort is considered good enough. And I literally can't think of the last time. I have to go back to The Big Lebowski to find a film that I genuinely belly laughed at and was consistently brilliant in its comic roots. Am I just being silly here? Or
imagine there must have been something in 15
help me out.
Years since The Big Lebowski came out, but I'll admit I can't immediately bring a name to mind.
No, I mean, I'm normally a fairly big fan of the sort of stupid, biggish, budget, glossy Hollywood comedy, which normally would star Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
And I've liked most of those. I mean, certainly I would, although none of them are in great works of art, I've liked a lot of those over the years. Not so much recently, which is why I'm kind of holding out some hope for Anchorman 2, but I'm not going to get my hopes up too much. Again, I was looking forward to Burt Wonderstone just because of the cast, and it's a bit disappointing that it doesn't seem to have quite taken fancy. I mean, I think most of the films, comedy films, I think, recently that I've laughed at are probably a bit blacker, you know, things like In Bruges or something along those kind of lines.
In terms of out-and-out comedy, I think you're probably right, actually. Anchorman is one thing that I could reach to now that you've mentioned it.
I mean, I don't think it's so bleak. Certainly, I've gone into a great number of films and came out laughing quite a lot. And things like The Muppets or something else.
I've seen a lot of funny films, but they're not quite affected me quite so much that I can immediately bring them to mind. Whereas a film from 15 years ago, it's more or less always in my mind. Yeah. So,
if you're going to start comparing everything to The Big Lebowski, everything is going to be found wanting.
You're on a hiding to nothing. No, it's like you say, I'd much rather go into something like this with a sense of optimism than one of the Judd Apatow stable of films. They're of no interest to me whatsoever. I just feel like they're manufactured under false pretense, where at least this sets out to be just a daft, silly comedy, and I'll grant it that much. But for something like this, and I haven't really seen that sort of Vegas showbiz thing lampooned all that often, I can't think of a film which has picked it as a target, even though it's actually quite so obvious. So you'd think there's plenty of stuff here which is like virgin territory to be plundered for comic effect, and it just it doesn't really take any opportunities. Like Carell and Buscemi, when they're introduced, their actual double act on stage is like entirely believable as a Las Vegas sort of casino show, but that in itself is not, above and beyond the obvious, that itself is not sort of hugely comic. So you would hope that once this situation arrives and once these guys have a fallen out and you have this David Blaine-alike street magician who's more interested with stunts like holding his urine for 72 hours and who performs these street magic tricks where it's not enough just to produce a card that a guy's written his mum's name on. He has to get the guy to punch him in his face so that his face swells up, and then he cuts his cheek open with a knife and pulls the card from out inside his cheek. It's like... you know, that's Jim Carrey gets all the big laughs. That's the only part that seems to have any sort of inspiration to it. And the rest is just really sort of not broad comedy in the sense of brassy, but just broad in the sense of it's just kind of loose. And there's nothing like chronically funny in there. And you've got like Jay Moore in there, who's, you know, take him or leave him, but he can be a pretty funny guy. And he has played a couple of really funny roles. And his role in this has actually had the potential to be really quite cool as well, just as a side character, but nothing really ever comes of it. And it's just like, it's just a little bit too flat. But like I say, you know, at least it's one of those films where I checked it out on IMDb when I got home and I thought, oh Christ, the budget, I bet the budget for this is like 70 million or something. By the time you take these, it's going to be a nightmare because I know it's bombed and it's opening weekend in the States and whatnot. But actually I'm like, all right, okay, 30 million. It's not the end of the world, you know. But I'd hoped for so much more. Steve Carell, okay, he's not my favourite comic actor, but he has been pretty funny in stuff like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and some other films that escape me right now. But just like a big missed opportunity when you have something which is so ripe for lampooning, to miss so many obvious opportunities and deliver something so lukewarm is just, yeah, it's a bit of a disappointment. But there you go. Scott, what would you like to tell us about Side Effects, man?
Side Effects sees Emily, played by Rooney Mara. She's struggling with life after the return of her husband, Martin, played by Channing Tatum, from prison after a stint inside for insider trading. In what she later describes as a momentary lapse, she drives her car at speed into a wall of her garage. While getting checked out in hospital, her psychiatrist, Dr. Jonathan Banks, is called in to consult, and after promising to start a series of consultations, she's released. At these sessions, in amongst fleshing out some of the characterisation of both Jonathan and Emily and their whole life, a drug is prescribed to deal with the anxiety that Emily is facing. This has an unfortunate side effect in as much as Emily starts sleepwalking, and, well, apparently sleep preparing breakfast as well. This only seems mildly irritating at first, until Emily wakes up covered in blood, holding a knife, and with Martin dead on the floor. The film then starts to go in a path of trying to work out if Emily is truly responsible for her actions while under the influence of these drugs, and also how much responsibility her doctor should shoulder in this situation, and of course how all involved handle the stress that this situation causes. It makes a credible show of heading along this path quite nicely, with characters reacting in fairly believable ways, till it takes a bit of a twist in the third act that, in common with all reviews, I very much feel it would completely ruin the film if revealed, so I shan't, although I will circle back to it in a few moments. In terms of performances, Jude Law is an actor I've often struggled to get a hold on. He's got talent, certainly, and he has a certain sense of style and a decent amount of charisma, but somehow that never seems to translate into great leading role performances, especially if the role's calling for a kind of smiley, chirpy kind of lead. Witness the horrors of the remake of Alfie. Yet,
which unfortunately I did, and thanks for bringing that back to my mind. You bastard.
I've dodged that one.
Yeah, when he's playing a more restrained and complicated role, such as in Gattaca, which was probably the first time he actually grabbed my attention, he can be pretty brilliant. And of late, I think we've started to see a few more, at least people have been able to harness his kind of natural capacity a bit better, and we see a bit more sort of charming personality from him, and this continues on that trajectory. Jonathan Banks isn't a desperately complicated character, but there is enough hints of something in the past that's not completely squeaky clean that gives it just the right edge, just the right element of edginess to the character to lift it off the page somewhat and make it a little bit more interesting and compelling, and gives Law something to get his teeth into. Rooney Mara's character is equally well portrayed, although by the very nature of the character and her condition and also the drugs that she's on, it's very cold performance, very deliberately, of course, due to the nature of the character. It's a little harder to get behind her, but again, that's kind of the point of the film. It's dealing with her alienation from the world, or is it? ? Steven Soderbergh, of which this is self-proclaimed to be his last feature film, which I'm sure I'd heard before, but in relation to some other films, but if anything, we'll see how that holds up. At his best, Soderbergh has quite a talent for getting some pretty good performances out of people that you wouldn't necessarily expect to get them from, and he does the same here. Not only the two leads in Jude Law and Rooney Mara give solid performances, even Channing Tatum and Catherine Zeta-Jones give fairly likeable performances, and again, who would have thought any of that could happen?
Possibly. And of the only handful of Catherine Zeta-Jones performances have actually been any good, one of the most notable ones was her role in Traffic, directed by Steven Soderbergh, yes. So he does have the key to getting her to be a good performance on screen. Well, she'd share it.
She should write his notes down somewhere. The actual plot of Side Effect is somewhat conventional. It's a fairly conventional tale, but it is told with a degree of panache that elevates it from something that could well have... It could believably have been a made-for-TV movie. When you actually, I suspect if you read the script, it would probably not jump out at you as being something that was exceptional. The one thing that perhaps is, again, coming back to it, is this twist. Now, I will be very careful in how I word this. I mean, it's an interesting
twist. Bruce
Willis
is a ghost!
Sadly not. It's an interesting twist, but it's kind of a cheat.
It's a sledge!
It deserves some credit for being Darth Vader's father. it deserves some credit for being reasonably plausible as these things go. It's not something as stupendously idiotic as in, say, Identity, where the film turned out to be a personalization of some nutter's multiple personality disorder flare-up or anything like that. This is, if not particularly likely, at least largely possible. No, it cheats by being unpredictable purely on the basis of not telling you any of the information you would need to predict it until well after the twist occurs. And even then, it's not particularly well illuminated. It's not just that it's hiding the corners of the plot's jigsaw puzzle pieces from you, it's hiding all of them. And the picture of what the puzzle is. And then it turns out you should have been playing Hungry Hungry Hippos anyway. Even if it's not a narrative twist for ages, it's a solid one. And as it's not a last-minute middle finger, it does give the protagonists enough time to deal with the reveal, and it allows the film to retain its prevailing character arcs and also give a sense of conclusion to the story. It's not just a twist end. It's a twist and it gives people a reasonable amount of time to deal with it, and it's a much stronger film for that. So it's certainly a better film than Identity, but then there's not too many worse films than Identity, so that's not saying much. So, summing up, Identity is a really terrible film and you definitely shouldn't watch it. Side Effects actually has got quite a lot going for it, and you probably at least deserves consideration in your viewing schedule. Maybe not, again, something that you necessarily need to rush out and see at cinema. I think this will be equally efficient seen at home. It's got strong performances, it's got a solid script and stylish, efficient direction from Soderbergh. It's not the most exciting film from which to leave a directorial career, I suppose. It would seem more appropriate if it was either an envelope-pushing masterpiece or an envelope-pushing disaster, and a solid, well-told B-minus drama doesn't seem to be the most fitting way to bookend Soderbergh's movie career. And perhaps that's the greatest twist of them all.
Ooh.
No, enjoyable, definitely worth a look. Not, as with Parker, not spectacular enough to rush out for, but certainly something that should perhaps deserve some consideration on your schedules.
Ganz interessant, as our German friends would say. All right then, so on to our on-demand/rental/catch-up film for this week. Savages. Now, Oliver Stone is one of the few directors working today about whom you could say that when he's not in top form, he is at least almost always producing something interesting. Such was the case with the often underrated U-Turn, a modern noir that mixed blazing oppressive sunshine with coal black humour and perfectly unhinged performances. Unfortunately, the only thing Savages shares with that film is the blazing sunshine. Ben, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and the annoyingly named Chon, Taylor Kitsch, are a sub-hippie botanist and an ex-US Marine respectively, the former a charitable, fair-trading, pot-growing genius, and the latter more attuned to doling out violence when necessary to the business. Apparently hetero life partners, Ben and Chon share their girlfriend O, Blake Lively, the film's narrator, and life under the Californian sun seems oh so perfect until an uber-violent Mexican cartel led by Elena...
Is there another type?
Yes, an impressively off-type Salma Hayek shows a thinly veiled interest in consulting consolidating Ben and Chon's business with their own. Our trendy duo dismiss said cartel, and it isn't long before O is kidnapped and things begin to spiral out of control with predictably gruesome consequences. An impressive supporting cast is rounded out by a pleasantly cake makeup-free John Travolta as a corrupt fed feeding off the boys' business, and Benicio del Toro as Elena's chief enforcer, a man terrifyingly predisposed to violence at the end of any number of implements of torture. Now, Scott, what disappointed me most is that several days after watching this, I'm still struggling to figure out what I'm supposed to have taken away from Savages. I cannot for the life of me tell if I'm supposed to be taking the central trio seriously or if I'm supposed to be sneering at their self-indulgent boho lifestyle. Is this something wantonly dicing with death at every turn? Is this something that you experienced?
Well, as greater philosophers over time have observed, it's not gay when it's in a freeway. There's just... Right, my notes for this film that I made coming into it, I have a cast list copied off IMDb. I got as far as writing elaborate practical joke. And that is basically... that is more or less where I could leave it. There is just nothing in here that is of really any interest or believability. The performance... Well, not performances of leads are lacking, but I don't think you could have put anyone in here that would have made such a trio of unbelievable characters with just the most ridiculous relationship and have that make any sort of sense to anyone. But I'm struck by something that was a conversation Drew had with someone at a film festival a few years back. If you try and think of any film with a voiceover narration element to it and... think of any one of those
that would not be improved immensely
by taking that away. This was possibly an exception because it would be dismal either way. Blake Lively's a just wet blanket of a character, and even when she's been treated so badly, it's difficult to care even slightly about her plight.
Because wet blanket.
She's just nothing. She's content-free, calorie-free.
It's not that I found the film... offensively unlikable. It's just that, like, that the central trio aside, okay, there's something in the weight of the subject matter kind of almost balanced for me, almost balanced out. I mean, I've no idea what the message is supposed to be. Apparently the message is don't fuck with Mexican drug cartels, which is something I'd taken as a given. Yes. Anyway, you know, I try and do that at the same time as I'm looking left and right before crossing the road. So it's like, okay, so the gravitas of the subject matter kind of balanced out this annoying trio of characters who are at the heart of the story. And so I was left with this like net gain of zero, where I'm in this bizarre position where it's just, I just don't care enough to even have an opinion. And it's the first time in ages I've been left so, I can't even be angry at it. I mean, are you actively angry at it? Because I can't even muster anger. It's this bizarre zero-sum game of a film that I haven't come across before.
I couldn't find anything to be positive about, so I just default to anger in a general state of mind. There's just nothing in there that is remotely useful or likeable. I mean, even the normally dependable Benicio del Toro's camping around like some kind of arsehole. I mean, it's a dreadful character with horrible accents and just dreadful performances. He's playing some kind of long game of double-crossing with other people, but just none of that makes any sort of real sense or interest. And no one's motivation is particularly well explained outside of your two heroes, Taylor Kitsch and Aaron Taylor-Johnston, and their motivation is simple, but hampered somewhat by their inherent unlikability. What is the point of any of this? I mean, it seems to be an elaborate excuse just to set up a couple of underwhelming action scenes and then have John Travolta whirl in a helicopter and end it. I mean, it's the sort of film that goes to the bother of presenting you with two endings, both of which suck.
Well, that's what cracks me up as well when you mentioned Benicio del Toro's character, is that he's like the most horrendous scumbag on the planet. And then in one of these endings, he tries to stave off impending death by trying to convince someone not to shoot him in the face by saying, "I've got a wife and kids." You're the world's most disgusting, violent cretin. I don't care if you're the benefactor of any number of like children's charities and whatnot, and these children's lives are dependent on you. I'm going to wipe you out anyway. It's clearly the best thing to do.
The type of person that's going to consider shooting somebody in the face is not the sort of person to be persuaded by such arguments anyway.
It's totally bizarre. It's empty calories. Like, and for me as well, what was bizarre about it was directorially, and again, I don't know if... Oliver Stone's one of those guys I don't want to second guess him. I'm like, I don't know... Perhaps even the style he's adopted with this film is choice on his part, is part of whatever presumably cryptic but hitherto unfathomable, unseen, undetectable message there may be within. I think I tweeted something about it in the one-liner timeline about, it struck me as the style, it's unlike anything I've seen him do before, and it's this bizarre, like, Jerry Bruckheimer kind of look of, like, super saturated colour and this bright sunshine, and it's almost like, I think I said it's like Tony, if Tony Scott had directed whatever, can't remember what flippant comment I made, but it's like Tony Scott and Diazepam. It's like if you took away the shaky cam from Tony Scott but kept, like, the super saturated colour and told him to ease off on the jump cuts and stuff like that. Nothing about it suggested to me Oliver Stone, and it's the first time I felt that one of his works hasn't really borne any of his hallmarks at all. There's no discernible quality of Oliver Stone in there, other than perhaps his ability to marshal this impressive cast in bit roles around these three unconscionable pricks.
Oliver Stone's... I can normally find something at least interesting in most of his films, even if I don't like an awful lot of
like
them.
JFK, you're particularly fond
JFK
of that.
JFK makes me so spitting angry that I can't quite believe it.
But at least it's interesting.
It's interesting enough, and even on his off days, I don't think the general consensus was particularly strongly behind, you know, Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, but I thought it was fine.
I really liked that, actually.
There's normally something interesting in most things, apart from maybe World Trade Center.
Well, I don't know. I can't say you'd find a lot interesting in W. I didn't see the point of that film at all.
No, I guess not. But there's just nothing in Savages.
It's empty calories, isn't it?
I don't see what the purpose of any of it is, other than to set up a couple of action scenes. It's like 2 hours of dicking around to get a couple of shootouts, none of which really have any real impact or anything. The characters are boring. No, nothing develops in any way. I don't feel that we've learned anything by the end of it. I don't feel that we've got any kind of insight into anything that's going on with any of the people in the film. It was, to be fair, always going to be an automatic zero-star film for me when I realised that the guy was not called John, but Sean.
And can I just say, it took me an hour to realise that, and that's only because at that point I was flicking idly through the IMDb app on my iPhone trying to find something interesting about the film. And I thought, oh, this annoyingly named prick of a woman isn't just pronouncing the name John slightly interestingly.
Yeah. There's just nothing in here that I can point to recommend it. It just doesn't have any point to anything that goes on it, and it's not particularly enjoyably unfolding the way that, I mean, God, if you're mentioning Tony Scott, a lot of his films have no point whatsoever, but they're quite entertainingly well told in the way to get up there, and it's, you know, interesting visual aspects and all these other kind of...
Yeah, they've at least got the good grace to punch you in the eye.
Yeah, I mean, his films are much as about the look and the style and the flash of it as it is the substance, and which is not normally Stone's stronger points, but there's just really nothing here. But no, I don't understand why it was made, or why anyone in it is cast in it, or why any of the film exists, or why any of the characters do anything that they do. Everyone's motivations are either amazingly simplistic or just pointlessly dumb.
Do you know what it is? It's a Coke Zero version of a Ridley Scott film like True Romance that would have been scripted by Tarantino, but if Tarantino had done that thing that we've all been asking him to do for over a decade now and stop writing characters as if it's his words coming out of their mouths. The improbability of it, and the sort of fucking annoying characters who at some points I'm bizarrely being asked to have some sort of empathy with, when they've had no empathic characteristics whatsoever. They've displayed no iota of anything that I can relate to. Bizarre.
The only thing I can think of, it revolves around some kind of breaking up of egos and ids and these kind of things, because the central relationship between Chon and Ben is just so completely unrealistic, in as much as Ben is the stereotypical tree-hugging hippie, and Chon is a dash-of-the-wool, bloodthirsty killer. And the only way
kill Ben the minute he saw him, just because he would annoy him so much.
I mean, the only way I can have this make any sort of sense in my head is if, like, there's, like, two aspects of the same character, or it was going to do something stupid like that and have, like, you know, his good half and his moralistic half and his animalistic half kind of split off into two separate characters, and that being, you know, Chon and Ben. But no, it's just stupid is what they decided to go with in the end.
Yeah. He's an industrial scale pot grower who's got the feds in his pockets, but at the same time, oh look, he's laughing and smiling with African children whom he's buying laptops for. He's digging wells with them. Oh, he's such a good guy, is Ben. No, he's a knob end. They're all knob ends.
Yes, and John's response to any problem, no matter how small, is to shoot it.
Yeah.
His first instinct is, let's shoot them.
Yeah, they're so obviously crass, annoying. I'm clawing for something. I'm thinking there must be something he's trying to tell us about these people, because I know he doesn't want us to like them or find some sort of redemptive quality in them. Well, there's no way Oliver Stone would ask me to do that unless he's had a stroke or something. I don't know. Oliver Stone, have you had a stroke? Why would that impair your judgment on these things? It wouldn't. So it can't even be that.
Recommendation is to avoid.
Weird. Savages, don't check it out. Don't. The man has a legacy of film that in some parts is up there with the Kubricks of the world. And then now this, what? W, World Trade Center, this. What are you doing, Stone? What are you doing? Oh, dearie me. Well, there you go then. That'll be that. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget, @TheOneLiner on Twitter is where you can find us there. You will also find us individually. We're not so hard to track down on there. Also, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do that via Twitter, or you can email us at podcast@theoneliner.com. You could perhaps, I don't know, hire a biplane to fly over either Glasgow, Falkirk, or Queens Ferry in North Wales with a banner trailing behind it. If you want to pass us a message that way, whatever. Get creative. It's not a problem. Yeah, it's not a problem. We'll take you as we find you. That'd be great. If you do get 5 seconds, I'm cutting it down from 10 seconds that I've mentioned in previous podcasts to 5 seconds now, because it really is that long. Do us a favour. Click on the link in iTunes. Just drop us a rating. If you've got 20 seconds, write us a 3-word review. It will help massively with our ratings. With that, I was Craig. As always, Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was Drew.
Wow.
Oh, you didn't think I had it in you, man.
I did not think you would manage that.
Why do the people do?
Bye bye.
Oh, I couldn't resist. Alright, take it easy, guys. Bye. Sorry, I've got peanut. Give me 2 seconds, I've just got an annoying bit of peanut stuck in my teeth. It's not even like stuck in my teeth, to be honest. It's kind of rattling about freely, but like constrained to a particular locale. I can't seem to shift it. It's like Heisenberg. It's like I can tell.
Heisenberg's
I can't intercept it because I can either tell where it is, but I can't anticipate which direction it's going or at what velocity. Or I have an idea of how quickly it's batting around, but I can't tell where it is. Heisenberg's UK snacks original salted peanut principle.